Welcome to Compassion Collective. This episode is brought to you by your hosts, Michaela Swee and Susan Murray, co-founders of Compassion Collective. Audio editing by Kyle Turner. Music by singer-songwriter Michael Shines.
So today we have our guest, Dr. Kelly Wilson, with us. We're very excited to have Kelly here. Kelly is a clinical psychologist and professor emeritus of psychology at the University of Mississippi. Kelly, along with Dr. Steve Hayes and others, is known as one of the original co-founders of Acceptance and Commitment Therapy, which we also call ACT, a transdiagnostic psychotherapy that emphasizes mindfulness, acceptance, and values-based strategies to help people with a variety of struggles live more meaningful, fulfilling lives. Kelly has co-authored over 100 peer-reviewed articles, books, book chapters, and treatment manuals on the topics of ACT and behavior analysis. He currently resides in Tucson, Arizona, with his wife, Diana, and together they run One Life Education and Training, where they provide consultation, workshops, clinical training, and engage in treatment protocol development. Kelly, thank you so much for joining us today. We're really excited to be speaking with you.
I'm happy to be here.
So to get us started as a jumping off point, for people who have no familiarity with ACT whatsoever, can you give folks a sense of what ACT is? What's this acceptance and commitment stuff all about? And where does compassion fit into it?
Oh, goodness. So ACT is a model of psychotherapy that is a way to speak about human suffering and human difficulty. It comes out of a behavioral tradition, although people may hear that and feel a certain sense of prejudice because people are often wrongly educated that behaviorism is some kind of deterministic, mechanical man version of psychology. If people hang in there and listen for the next hour, I think that they'll walk away with a different idea of what behaviorism might sound like. The behaviorism that I know and love, and it's the one that ACT comes out of, is a behaviorism based on this, I think, really very simple idea, and that is that behavior is influenced by context, that context matters, and that if we want to understand a particular instance of behavior, then we'll do well to understand the context in which that behavior is situated. And some contexts, that people are situated in are things like their families and their workplace environments and their, marriages and relationships with children. Some of them, the context that people's lives are situated in are cultures, sort of writ large, and the ways that we are expected to behave, the ways that the culture teaches us we ought to behave, including what we ought to feel and what we ought to think and what we ought to do. And we think that there are a number of those that aren't serving us terribly well. And so ACT is based on some ideas. I think they can be expressed pretty simply. I think that these ideas are not original entirely to ACT, that a lot of them exist in people's lives in the best moments of their life. They exist in all of the wisdom traditions, in the poetic and literary traditions. But ACT is an attempt to systematize these ideas in a way where they can be investigated scientifically and applied to human suffering in a lot of different contexts. So I told you I didn't know the short answer to anything. So this is a pretty good example of that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So the therapy, you could slice it a few different ways, but one way to slice it is to think about it in terms of kind of three main slices of the work. So one of the slices of the work involves practices of getting present in life. And it's not too hard for anyone to understand with technical training or without that we sometimes lose the moments that we inhabit by worrying about what will happen later, by ruminating over what has happened before. And in those exact moments that we're, you know, engaged with what has happened, what will happen, sometimes we miss that there's someone right there next to us who could use our attention, who could use our care. And being a behaviorist, we think that people can practice getting present, can practice letting go of endless worry and rumination, and come back to the, you know, actual lived moments of their lives.
I just want to ask a question based on what you just said, because basically you outlined two of the ways that we don't stay present, worrying about the future, thinking about the past. I've been curious lately about what other things might get in the way of being present moment focused. And I'm curious what you think about the idea that being present moment focused, like, for example, with your own life or with someone else in front of you, could involve a level of vulnerability or openness that I don't know that people might struggle with.
Unquestionably. Yeah. Yeah. There's, and in fact, when I've trained people in this work, I've sometimes described the situation people find themselves in as sort of present momentophobic. Being present can be terribly scary. Even though worry and rumination don't seem pleasant, they are at least familiar. And our evolution on the savannah, you know, taught us to prefer, you know, things that are known and predictable over things that are unknown and unpredictable. You're right, showing up involves a certain sort of vulnerability. You know, one of the reasons, that is one of the reasons that we talk about present moment processes in terms of practice inside of ACT. You know, I'm a pretty serious yoga practitioner. And, you know, one of the things that one of my early teachers taught that really stayed with me over the years was I was in a class and doing tree pose, which involves, you know, standing on one foot with the other lifted. And mm-hmm. I persistently tip over, you know. I mean, it is extraordinary how challenging that simple pose can be for me. And Stevie Self, my first yoga teacher, said, what if falling were part of the pose? Mm. Yeah, yeah. And it really stayed with me, you know, over the last decade. And I thought about how many places that was true. Like in yoga, the only people who don't fall are the people who don't practice. And I would say this business of getting present, it will be scary sometimes and you'll be distracted. And I would invite people, you know, if they are, you know, and I'd put this in scare quotes, not good at being present, that they could maybe, like my yoga teacher said to me, let falling be part of the pose. You know, it is in the nature of practicing being present that we fall out of being present. And, you know, the thing to do in those moments is to notice that we're not present and then allow ourselves to gently come back to the moment that we're inhabiting.
Yeah, well, I was just wondering, do you have ways that help you to get back, or ways, you know, that signals to you that you are not present focused, and different ways to gently guide yourself back?
Well, being out of the moment, like the kind of phenomenology of that, the internal quality of it, for me, is always, it feels pressured. It feels like a gears grinding. It feels like a clock wound a little too tight. So I think people can notice it in that way. You know, physically, I think it's a felt thing. So it's not just a cognitive thing. It's a whole life, a whole body experience. The cognitive elements are there. You know, it's very often future-oriented or past-oriented, and not in a way that feels healthy and vital. Yesterday, I went out on a hike in the mountains, and my anticipation of that, you know, I was kind of thinking ahead to where I might go on this series of trails that I'm exploring. You know, that's certainly me thinking ahead, but it has none of the kind of constricting and constraining qualities that go with, you know, this kind of more fear-oriented, tighter kind of connection to future and past.
It's really interesting. I had the experience just the other night. I have been trying to make a conscious effort, you know, with all of the stress and anxiety and fear and uncertainty that we're all holding and grappling with right now. I was trying to work meditation into my daily schedule in a more intentional way. And I noticed last week as I was trying to do that daily, and I was just trying to commit to like 10 minutes, just to be really intentional about that. And I noticed as I was doing it, it's obviously very common for me and I think everyone else, when we sit down to meditate, to really slow down and get in touch, you know, our minds do their job. They just go in all different directions. And my mind was doing that. But what was so interesting is I wasn't noticing that it was doing that until like 10 minutes down the line. And so it wasn't just this like cognitive experience of my realizing after the fact, like, whoa, I've been missing. But I also realized like it was a bodily missingness too.
Sure, sure.
That sometimes I can have the experience where I am really in my body and I'm noticing my mind doing what it does. But this was sort of an interesting experience where I felt like I lost my body in all of it too. I lost, you know, tracking and noticing my breath. I lost that all. It was really interesting.
Well, let me because you sort of said it in your description there. Let me just loop back around to your original question about ACT. So part of it is being where we are. And, you know, you talked about the vulnerability of that, and you talked about, you know, your own sort of being in the midst of scariness and fear. So the second, I think, really important sort of slice of ACT is opening up. You know, I describe it in my sort of practice version that I talk with clients about and trainees about as practicing an open heart. That's kind of a counterintuitive thing, you know. To withdraw from pain is a very natural thing, but people also have it in their own experiences that the things that we love the most are intimately connected to our greatest vulnerabilities. I heard someone say once that having children is like having your heart on the outside of your body. And as a parent of three, I can attest to the truth of that. When we love things deeply in our lives, we open ourselves up to pain. And this has to do with things like relationships, but it has to do with, you know, I have a daughter who's an artist. It has to do with creativity. You know, the moment you begin a creative act, you sort of put your heart on the table. It, you know, there's that possibility of rejection. There's that possibility of not being understood. There's that possibility of not executing in the way that you wanted to. The trouble with, you know, always, you know, sort of following the rule, if it hurts, turn away. Is that there isn't any way to turn away from what hurts without turning away also from what you care about. So part of ACT is this practice of opening up. So getting present, and opening up. And then the third sort of important slice of the model is becoming engaged. So what is it that I care about? What is it that I would like to invest my life in? And coming back to that. Now, when you asked me that question about process, like what do you do when you notice that you're not there?
Right.
That has happened to me way more times than not when I've been about to do a presentation or a workshop, and I get just filled with terror about whether I'll be adequate to the task or not. The thing that brings me back for me is that I ask myself, why am I here? You know, I'm standing in this really scary place and I'm not here by coincidence. There's something that I care about here. And when I look around rooms full of people who have, you know, taken time out of their schedules, who are serving other people with great need, I know why I'm there. And in that moment, I let what matters to me be more important than managing my fear and anxiety. It anchors me.
For someone who feels like, oh, like I struggle with this, I don't really know where to start with this. When you were talking about practices, like practices toward being present-minded and what you're even talking about now, tuning into what really matters to you, you know, how might someone do that in the morning, like getting ready for work or on their way to work? How does one do that in the small moments?
You know, one of the things that I thought about, you know, when you were talking about this, making your practice more intentional, and you were talking about just 10 minutes, and I thought, oh my, 10 minutes. That's a lot. In one of my books, it's nominally a book about substance use, a workbook about substance use called The Wisdom to Know the Difference. I have a meditation in there that I offer that's called Six Breaths on Purpose. Six breaths on purpose. And so maybe if it'd be okay, I could take you on a little six breaths on purpose meditation right now. Would that be okay?
We would love that.
And I would be willing to guide it. So if maybe you and the people who are listening could just pause for just a moment and allow your breath to rise and fall and just notice the shape your body is taking right now. And maybe if you're busy, you can just stop. And I want to invite you to just begin to notice the rise and fall of your own breath. And to notice the little changes in sensation as your breath rises to fullness and then softening as it falls away. And we'll just stop for six breaths. And if your mind goes away, just come back to breath. And six. Now, the beauty of a six breaths on purpose meditation is that you can't really say you don't have time. And And, you know, I'll give this. I for years, I gave this to my undergraduate classes, this six breaths on purpose meditation. I tell them, you know, if you want to do a longer meditation, go ahead, but just six, you know, and you can just count them, you know. You know, you can just count each exhalation. And when your mind wanders off, just return and don't worry too much about the count, but about six. And then just one last breath and then move on. Now, you know, this is the kind of thing that you can do while your car warms up before you leave for work in the morning. You know, it's the kind of thing that you can do like right before you come into the house after work. You could just stop and take six breaths on purpose. If people can establish a tiny little practice like that, you know, what'll happen is that they'll very often pause for just a few breaths more.
Yeah, it creates an opening.
Just a little.
Just a little, yeah.
Yeah. And it also creates a little opening with the people around you. You know, because we're social mammals. You know, if you've ever watched the great herd animals, you know, on the nature programs, you could watch them move together in sync, you know, and when some of them begin to run, then the others begin to run. And then when some of them begin to slow down, the others slow down. Well, we can be intentional about that, a sort of intentional locus of slowing down in our lives.
I'm curious to know, Kelly, for you, it sounds like you do make a practice out of a lot of this stuff. And I'm curious if you always have, or, you know, if there have been different times in your life where really being mindful in these ways has been more difficult than others. And if you could share some of that, if you'd be willing to share sort of your personal journey of what led you here, how you realized for yourself, oof, this stuff is really critical. This is really important.
Boy.
How you grew into it.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I got started in this like super accidentally. I literally was in the midst of doing something badly and sort of stopped because, you know, sometimes just, you know, not doing more damage is, you know, like a good thing. So really, I would put a dot on the place where this practice got started for me back to the very early 1990s when I was a novice, a brand new psychotherapist. And I noticed when I was in session with clients that I would have these moments where I would kind of, like, have you ever had the experience like where you're driving like on the freeway or something like that and you're kind of lost in thought and all of a sudden you realize that you've just been absent and you like don't even know exactly where you are, mm-hmm. you know, but you somehow have it run off the road. Well, see, I was having that experience with clients, like where I would be off in my head and I would suddenly have this moment where I looked across from me and thought, oh my goodness, here's this person in need pouring their heart out and I have no idea what they're talking about. And I was appalled, you know, like I just thought, oh my God, I'm a terrible person and a terrible therapist. And you know, I at the time, you know, when it happened initially, I sort of nodded and pretty quickly I could kind of catch up with them, but it seemed sort of dishonest and awful, you know. And so I remember asking my clients at the time that I wanted to be sure that I was actually hearing them. And I began to ask them to just pause a moment and to speak whatever it is that they had just spoken again, like slowly so that I could really listen to the words. And sometimes I would ask them to repeat themselves, like almost more like poetry than like prose, you know, pausing between the words. In those pauses of people telling their stories, you know, slowly, like poetry, hesitating over the kind of quiet moments in there, all of this sort of richness of their histories just sort of welled up in the midst of it. And I had one client who was a budding artist at the time who did a series of paintings called Stopping, because she and I learned to stop together. And it was in those, you know, moments of not planning and not getting busy and not getting anywhere that we found this kind of richness of living. So it really wasn't even intentionally a mindfulness practice. And it was only really later in my career when somebody who actually is knowledgeable about mindfulness pointed out that my own work had some connection to mindfulness. I certainly wasn't aware of it.
Wow. But it was just this understanding and experience of realizing that you were moving quickly, that you were missing things. And it sounds like what came out of that was a symbiosis. It sounds like it was a symbiotic slowing down that not only helped you obviously be more present and available in the room, but also the other person slowing down. It sounds like it was working for you individually, but also for you together.
Yeah. I mean, it was completely unexpected. And it came out of me being a bad listener. but it turns out that sometimes when people can slow down like that and hear their own story, you know, spoken aloud, mm-hmm. with a kind of a respectful kind of cadence, a certain reverence given to it, a certain quality of attention given to it, sometimes they hear their own story for the first time also. I mean, really hear it. I early was hesitant to use the word mindfulness because I felt like sort of a poser because, you know, I wasn't, you know, a Buddhist or, you know, I didn't know anything about that kind of stuff, really. I was invited in 2006 to present my work at the International Congress on Mindfulness in Bangor in Wales. The invitation came in the fall of 2005, actually, and I tried to talk them out of it. I said to my friend who invited me, I said, but I don't know anything about mindfulness. And Judith Soulsby is her name. She's a mindfulness teacher at Bangor. She was at the time. And she said, yes, you do. And I said, no, I don't. She said, yes, you do. And see, I have had a lot of good fortune in my life when I've had people who saw in me things I could not see in myself. So I just said, okay, I'll come.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was really the first time that I explicitly thought about my own work and its relationship to mindfulness.
Well, what's so interesting, Kelly, is I think that a key thing that we're hitting on here is that mindfulness is in the doing. I remember this actually just popped into my head. I remember at a workshop, you said, if you're talking about mindfulness, you're not doing mindfulness or something. It was something like that. And I think that that's relevant to what we're talking about here is that we can get so caught up in language and these words and talking about doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that seems to be, I think, what I'm getting from you. So when you actually were stopped and you're like thinking about talking about mindfulness or it, that's, you're doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, stories about swimming are great, but getting in the water, that's wonderful.
Right.
That's really wonderful. And, right. You know, what happened with me, I think, is I just sort of stumbled into the water and discovered how great it was. And, you know, later somebody said, that's swimming. And I'm like, oh, okay. I reluctantly accepted it, you know. Now, at that 2006 conference, John Kabat-Zinn was in my little workshop that I did there. And we did an exercise that I called Mindfulness for Two, which, you know, was this kind of, came out of this kind of question of, you know, what would mindfulness look like if, or what would it look like if we devoted the same care and attention to the interaction we had with our clients as we gave to our breath in a mindfulness meditation. And John sat kindly through my exercise on that. And I asked him on the break, I said, you know, I've been a little timid about calling this mindfulness. You know, what do you think? And John said, well, if this isn't mindfulness, I don't know what is. And I thought, well, if it's good enough for John, it's good enough for me.
Kelly, one of the things that I would love to talk about is in the time that Susan and I have spent with you and the workshops we've attended, I have to say, you're just one of those people, the way that you talk about shame is probably the most shame-reducing way that I've ever heard anyone talk about issues of shame before. And I'm really curious, when we're talking about compassion and self-compassion and acceptance, a lot of that is also around these monsters that we carry with us, mm-hmm. In feeling broken and feeling defective and feeling undeserving or unlovable, not good enough, all of these, again, back to these words. And I know that when you talk about this stuff, you're always so open, you know, about how these experiences are not unfamiliar to you. And I think you use that openness and personal experience as a way to connect with other people and also help people connect with each other and themselves. Mm-hmm. And I'm really curious to bring that into this conversation, talking about turning toward pain that we carry. And chances are this is pain we've carried for a very long time, for many years of our lives. I'm curious to know a little bit about how the conversation we're having about turning towards as opposed to turning away and presentness, how that applies and comes up in these really dark moments when we're really rejecting ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, what you're talking about there in some regards is the nature of the work that I've helped to develop. But it's also a description of my career. I spent the first 30 years of my life really walking around thinking that I was probably born on the wrong planet, that I was not like the people around me, that I was not as strong as they were, like I was made of like wet tissue, and you know the world was made of like stones and sharp sticks and filled with people who could inhabit such a world, you know. And I, you know, spent the first 30 years of my life making an enemy of my vulnerability, making an enemy of my own complexity. And, you know, my life did not start to change until I was 30, so 35 years ago, at a point when I couldn't fight anymore, where I was empty of any fight, you know, just too tired. And I made this kind of deal with the universe. You know, it was one of these kind of like, am I going to stay alive or not moments that I was intimate with. And I can even tell you the day, you know, it was June 1, 1985, when I decided to stay. And I knew, you know, that it was going to be painful. And so my agreement with the universe was sort of like, I will clean my plate, you know, like whatever the universe puts on my plate, I will take it in and say thank you, just like my mom taught me, you know. But there was like another part of it, and it was that it was going to have to be for something, you know, that made the pain worthwhile. And I had the good fortune of a series of teachers who I found who, you know, kept seeing in me something worthwhile. And when I looked inside, all I could find was vulnerabilities. So I've used what I have in abundance. And so when I teach about things like shame, I don't teach people things like, I don't give them, you never heard me, you know, you heard me teach about this and you said that it had an impact, but you never heard me tell you, oh, you shouldn't be ashamed, or, you know, nothing you did was so bad or anything. You know, what you heard me do is I talked about living inside of my own sense of shame. And I talked about the particulars of my own life in ways that you knew I wasn't kidding. You know, I talk about in the midst of the darkness of my life before 30, you know, I had a child 10 years before that little awakening that that I essentially abandoned. You know, I abandoned her as a little girl. You know, and I'm tearing up right now as I say that. Yeah. When I say that, you know, in a room with a couple of hundred people in it, you know, they know that I'm not just talking about some abstract principle. You know, that I'm talking about, you know, a real human life, like an actual little girl who had to wonder, you know, did Dad leave because I'm bad? Right? Yeah. Now see, when I talk about that, then people can, they listen, you know. They listen. And, you know, they see me there still alive. And they see me saying, you know, what if your own darkest moments could serve you? What if there's something in them that could serve you and serve the people around you? There's a guy named Brian Stevenson. And if you haven't heard of him, you should hear of him. He's got a book called Just Mercy, and there's a movie by the same name.
Yeah, I just saw it.
Yeah. So Brian has served children who are in prison. And I heard him speak some years back, and he says to this room full of people, and I was sitting close to him. I was probably 10 feet away up on the dais, you know. And he said, you are more than your greatest mistake. You are more than your greatest mistake. You know, and he says, further, he says, even if you're a murderer, you are more than your greatest mistake. Oh my goodness. You know, I thought to myself, you know, what if that is true of me? And I would ask everybody who's listening to that, what if it's true of you? You know, some of the people that Brian interacted with were wrongly convicted, but some of them were actually murderers. And he meant it. There's more to you than that.
What an offering to someone.
Amen.
Mm-hmm. What a generous, expansive view of a person.
Well, and I think, you know, going back to when we talk about compassion and we talk about this acknowledgement and seeing of suffering and self and others, and then this intention to meet it. And to try to alleviate it, I think that's so much of my experience of you, Kelly, in the workshops, doing exactly what you're talking about and what you just did, not even talked about what you did just now, that's compassion. I think there's something about you and one opening up and sharing this darkness, sharing this vulnerability with other people, that it's like a lifeline. And I mean, I felt that. I've experienced that with you, and you know, in the room, when I'm in the room with all the other people who are there for a workshop. There's something about this invitation, this really intentional invitation, and we don't invite ourselves in that way so much of the time.
No. And please believe me that when I make that invitation to you, I'm making it to me also, because I have need of it. I have great need of it, and I forget that. And in the teaching of it, it helps me to remember it. Mm. You know, one of the things that our culture teaches us, which I think is a dreadful thing, is that, you know, this nonsense about playing to our strengths and everything. I want you to notice, you know, and I can hear it in your voice that you're listening, you know, you listened to what I just said and you heard what I said, and you didn't hear it as merely an act of self-destructiveness. You heard a sense of hope in that. I want you to notice that what I brought you was not my strength, but my weakness.
Yeah. And it's so interesting, again, to think about how we hear other people in that way. Like my feeling as you're talking about that, I feel the pain, but it also feels so beautiful to me. I think the generosity and the openness and the rawness, like, there's real beauty in that. The last thing that I just wanted to ask you that I was just thinking about, Kelly, is this was the last workshop that we were at Iona College. And I remember you were talking about helping us come in contact with our own superpowers. Mm-hmm. And that was such a powerful experience for me to see these parts of myself that are so hard to hold and so hard to look at, and begin to see, you know, it's a subtle shift and it's a process, but beginning to see some of those things that I reject, some of those things that I hate, some of those things that I spent so much time and so many years fighting as my superpower. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious if you can, I don't know, there's a question in this. I'm just curious if you can speak to this, speak to...
Sure. You know, like, I love human beings, which is a pretty weird position for me to find myself in, because I didn't always. And, you know, one of the things I love about it is the extraordinary sort of variability in the human palate, you know. And, you know, like, I really love that human beings are not like Instagram personalities, you know? You know, like, I'm not really interested in the me that people would like me to see, or the me that people are afraid that I'll see, or the, you know, like, I'm interested in like whole persons. And, you know, the thing with these vulnerabilities, with these difficult aspects of ourselves, is that it's worth slowing down enough to try to notice whether it is the thing itself, or if it is what is done with it, that causes it to be so troublesome. So, you know, for example, if you take something like my social vulnerability, like, I am easy to hurt. I mean, really, really easy to hurt, and always have been. I mean, as a little boy, I got like the crying gene from my mom, you know, and like everything would make me cry. And, you know, just a word, just a look could send me to tears, you know. And especially, like, let me just promise you, growing up in the 1950s and 60s, you know, a boy with a girl's name like Kelly, you know, who cries at the drop of the hat, this was a cross to bear, you know, and I made an enemy of it, you know. And what I did with it was to try to pretend like it wasn't there, but I wasn't very good at that. And so when I was about 13, I figured out that I could drink and I could moderate it. And by the time I was, you know, 15, I figured out there was a whole array of chemicals out there that I could use to moderate it. And so in order to, you know, I thought the vulnerability was causing me the problem, but really what was causing me the problem was what I did with the vulnerability. You know, all of these attempts to hide it, to make it go away, to crush it down, to drug it away, to drink it away. Those were what were causing the problems. You know, after that, that choice point in, 1985, what I began to learn to do was to carry that vulnerability that I had a little more lightly. And what I ultimately found, and which is kind of one of those duh things, is that, you know, as a therapist and as a person who trains therapists, you know, it turns out that being very, very sensitive socially is an asset. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. like no kidding. And so that very thing that I thought was what was broken about me, and what I went to incredibly destructive lengths to try to, you know, as the song Hurt says, to kill it all away, was in fact an enormous asset to me. And my willingness to call that up in my own speaking and in my own presence has been like a big permission slip for other people to show up in their own lives and to wonder what wonderful good use there might be in their own differences and in their own vulnerabilities.
I love that. I love that so much. It's such a shift. It's such a different light, such a different vantage point.
You know, sometimes, and I know y'all are very interested in self-compassion. Sometimes I worry that self-compassion work, I mean, it can be used a lot of different ways. And so it's always really about function. But sometimes I think people try to use self-compassion work to try to sort of convince themselves, like as a kind of cognitive event, that they're like worthwhile human beings. And, I've just never had anyone be able to convince me of that. And I've never been able to convince myself of that. However, I have encountered circumstances where I have experienced the knowing of that and have precipitated circumstances where people can experience the knowing of that. That seems, it's less obvious than, you know, follow the rule, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and gosh darn it, people like me. So like, if people are like listening to this and they're wondering, what about me? What about me? Hmm. Let me just say, yes, yes, yes.
Thank you so much, Kelly.
Thank you, Kelly, for taking the time to be with us today and share your wisdom and beautiful understanding of the human condition.
You cannot know the laughing that occurs in my head when people talk about me and use words like the wisdom.
I know. You're still just you.
It's like a cacophony, you know. Like, oh.
Thank you. Well, again, I think, I don't know, then I guess I want to return to that idea of, or that feeling, that experience of co-creation, of the wisdom and of, I don't know, the experiences that we've had just in this hour together.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation. And, you know, in the midst of this whole COVID thing, there are like really a lot of things that I can't do. And I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to do something that I can do. It means a lot to me.
Thank you so much, Kelly. We're extremely, extremely grateful. Thank you all for listening to Compassion Collective. You can visit us on the web at compassion-collective.com. Please also consider donating to our Patreon fund at patreon.com/compassioncollective. We'll see you next time.